Blanche and Mary were of equal stature, straight and tall as poplars. Mary was too slim for her height, but Blanche was molded like a Dian. I regarded her, of course, with special interest. First, I wished to see whether her appearance accorded with Mrs. Fairfax's description. Secondly, whether it at all resembled the fancy miniature I had painted of her. And thirdly, it will out, whether it was such as I should fancy likely to suit Mr. Rochester's taste. As far as person went, she answered point for point, both to my picture and Mrs. Fairfax's description. The noble bust, the sloping shoulders, the graceful neck, the dark eyes and black ringlets were all there. But her face was like her mother's, a youthful, unfurrowed likeness, the same low brow, the same high features, the same pride. It was not, however, so saturnine a pride. She laughed continually. Her laugh was satirical, and so was the habitual expression of her arched and haughty lip. Genius is said to be self-conscious. I cannot tell whether Miss Ingram was a genius, but she was self-conscious, remarkably self-conscious indeed. She entered into a discourse on botany with the gentle Mrs. Dent. It seemed Mrs. Dent had not studied that science, though, as she said, she liked flowers, especially wild ones. Miss Ingram had, and she ran over its vocabulary with an air. I presently perceived she was, what is vernacularly termed, trailing Mrs. Dent, that is, playing on her ignorance. Her trail might be clever, but it was decidedly not good-natured. She played. Her execution was brilliant. She sang. Her voice was fine. She talked French apart to her mamma, and she talked it well, with fluency and with a good accent. Mary had a milder and more open countenance than Blanche, softer features, too, and a skin some shades fairer. Miss Ingram was dark as a Spaniard. But Mary was deficient in life. Her face lacked expression, her eye luster. She had nothing to say, and having once taken her seat, remained fixed like a statue in its niche. The sisters were both attired in spotless white. And did I now think Miss Ingram such a choice as Mr. Rochester would be likely to make? I could not tell. I did not know his taste in female beauty. If he liked the majestic, she was the very type of majesty. Then she was accomplished, sprightly. Most gentlemen would admire her, I thought, and that he did admire her, I already seemed to have obtained proof. To remove the last shade of doubt, it remained but to see them together. You are not to suppose, reader, that Adèle has all this time been sitting motionless on the stool at my feet. No, when the ladies entered, she rose, advanced to meet them, made a stately reverence, and said with gravity, "Bonjour, mesdames." And Miss Ingram had looked down at her with a mocking air, and exclaimed, "Oh, what a little puppet!" Lady Lynn had remarked, "It is Mr. Rochester's ward, I suppose, the little French girl he was speaking of." Mrs. Dent had kindly taken her hand and given her a kiss. Amy and Louisa Eshton had cried out simultaneously, "What a love of a child!" And then they had called her to a sofa, where she now sat ensconced between them, chattering alternately in French and broken English, absorbing not only the young lady's attention, but that of Mrs. Eshton and Lady Lynn, and getting spoilt to her heart's content. At last coffee is brought in, and the gentlemen are summoned. I sit in the shade, if any shade there be in this brilliantly lit apartment. The window curtain half hides me. Again the arch yawns, they come. The collective appearance of the gentlemen, like that of the ladies, is very imposing. They are all costumed in black. Most of them are tall, some young. Henry and Frederick Lynn are very dashing sparks indeed, and Colonel Dent is a fine, soldierly man. Mr. Eshton, the magistrate of the district, is gentlemanlike. His hair is quite white, his eyebrows and whiskers still dark, which gives him something of the appearance of a père noble de théâtre. Lord Ingram, like his sisters, is very tall. Like them, also, he is handsome. But he shares Mary's apathetic and listless look. He seems to have more length of limb than vivacity of blood or vigor of brain. And where is Mr. Rochester? He comes in last. I am not looking at the arch, yet I see him enter. I try to concentrate my attention on those netting needles, on the meshes of the purse I am forming. I wish to think only of the work I have in my hands, to see only the silver beads and silk threads that lie in my lap, whereas I distinctly behold his figure, and I inevitably recall the moment when I last saw it, just after I had rendered him what he deemed an essential service, and he, holding my hand and looking down on my face, surveyed me with eyes that revealed a heart full and eager to overflow, in whose emotions I had a part. How near had I approached him at that moment? What had occurred since, calculated to change his and my relative positions? Yet now, how distant, how far estranged we were. So far estranged that I did not expect him to come and speak to me. I did not wonder when, without looking at me, he took a seat at the other side of the room and began conversing with some of the ladies. No sooner did I see that his attention was riveted on them, and that I might gaze without being observed, than my eyes were drawn involuntarily to his face. I could not keep their lids under control. They would rise, and the irids would fix on him. I looked, and had an acute pleasure in looking, a precious yet poignant pleasure, pure gold with a steely point of agony, a pleasure like what the thirst-perishing man might feel, who knows the well to which he has crept is poisoned, yet stoops and drinks divine draughts nevertheless. Most true is it that beauty is in the eye of the gazer. My master's colourless olive face, square, massive brow, broad and jetty eyebrows, deep eyes, strong features, firm, grim mouth, all energy, decision, will, were not beautiful according to rule, but they were more than beautiful to me. They were full of an interest, an influence that quite mastered me, that took my feelings from my own power and fettered them in his. I had not intended to love him. The reader knows I had wrought hard to extirpate from my soul the germs of love there detected, and now, at the first renewed view of him, they spontaneously arrived, green and strong. He made me love him without looking at me. I compared him with his guests. What was the gallant grace of the Lynns, the languid elegance of Lord Ingram, even the military distinction of Colonel Dent, contrasted with his look of native pith and genuine power? I had no sympathy in their appearance, their expression, yet I could imagine that most observers would call them attractive, handsome, imposing, while they would pronounce Mr. Rochester at once harsh-featured and melancholy-looking. I saw them smile, laugh. It was nothing. The light of the candles had as much soul in it as their smile, the tinkle of the bell as much significance as their laugh. I saw Mr. Rochester smile. His stern features softened, his eye grew both brilliant and gentle, its ray both searching and sweet. He was talking at the moment to Louisa and Amy Ashton. I wondered to see them receive with calm that look which seemed to me so penetrating. I expected their eyes to fall, their colour to rise under it. Yet I was glad when I found they were in no sense moved. He is not to them what he is to me, I thought. He is not of their kind. I believe he is of mine. I am sure he is. I feel akin to him. I understand the language of his countenance and movements. Though rank and wealth sever us widely, I have something in my brain and heart, in my blood and nerves, that assimilates me mentally to him. Did I say, a few days since, that I had nothing to do with him but to receive my salary at his hands? Did I forbid myself to think of him in any other light than as a paymaster? Blasphemy against nature! Every good, true, vigorous feeling I have gathers impulsively round him. I know I must conceal my sentiments. I must smother hope. I must remember that he cannot care much for me. For when I say that I am of his kind, I do not mean that I have his force to influence and his spell to attract. I mean only that I have certain tastes and feelings in common with him. I must then repeat continually that we are forever sundered. And yet, while I breathe and think, I must love him. Coffee is handed. The ladies, since the gentlemen entered, have become lively as larks. Conversation waxes brisk and merry. Colonel Dent and Mr. Eshton argue on politics. Their wives listen. The two proud dowagers, Lady Lynn and Lady Ingram, confabulate together. Sir George, whom, by the by, I have forgotten to describe, a very big and very fresh-looking country gentleman, stands before their sofa, coffee cup in hand, and occasionally puts in a word. Mr. Frederick Lynn has taken a seat beside Mary Ingram, and is showing her the engravings of a splendid volume. She looks, smiles now and then, but apparently says little. The tall and phlegmatic Lord Ingram leans with folded arms on the chair-back of the little and lively Amy Eshton. She glances up at him and chatters like a wren. She likes him better than she does Mr. Rochester. Henry Lynn has taken possession of an ottoman at the feet of Louisa. Adele shares it with him. He is trying to talk French with her, and Louisa laughs at his blunders. With whom will Blanche Ingram pair? She is standing alone at the table, bending gracefully over an album. She seems waiting to be sought, but she will not wait too long. She herself selects a mate. Mr. Rochester, having quitted the Eshtons, stands on the hearth as solitary as she stands by the table. She confronts him, taking her station on the opposite side of the mantelpiece. "Mr. Rochester, I thought you were not fond of children. Nor am I. Then, what induced you to take charge of such a little doll as that?" pointing to Adele. "Where did you pick her up?" "I did not pick her up. She was left on my hands." "You should have sent her to school. I could not afford it. Schools are so dear." "Why, I suppose you have a governess for her. I saw a person with her just now. Is she gone?" "Oh, no, there she is still, behind the window curtain. You pay her, of course. I should think it quite as expensive, more so, for you have them both to keep in addition." I feared, or should I say, hoped, the allusion to me would make Mr. Rochester glance my way. I involuntarily shrank farther into the shade, but he never turned his eyes. "I have not considered the subject," said he indifferently, looking straight before him.
"No, you men never do consider economy and common sense. You should hear Mama on the chapter of governesses Mary and I have had, I should think, a dozen at least in our day, half of them detestable and the rest ridiculous, and all incubi, were they not, Mama? Did you speak, my own?
The young lady, thus claimed as the dowager's special property, reiterated her question with an explanation.
"My dearest, don't mention governesses. The word makes me nervous. I have suffered a martyrdom from their incompetency and caprice. I thank heaven I have now done with them."
Mrs. Dent here bent over to the pious lady and whispered something in her ear, I suppose, from the answer elicited. It was a reminder that one of the anathematized race was present.
"Tant pis," said her ladyship. "I hope it may do her good."
Then in a lower tone, but still loud enough for me to hear, "I noticed her. I am a judge of physiognomy, and in hers I see all the faults of her class."
"What are they, madam?" inquired Mr. Rochester aloud. "I will tell you in your private ear," replied she, wagging her turban three times with portentous significancy. "But my curiosity will be past its appetite. It craves food now. Ask Blanche. She is nearer you than I."
"Oh, don't refer him to me, Mama. I have just one word to say of the whole tribe. They are a nuisance. Not that I ever suffered much from them. I took care to turn the tables. What tricks Theodore and I used to play on our Miss Wilsons and Mrs. Grays and Madame Joubert. Mary was always too sleepy to join in a plot with spirit. The best fun was with Madame Joubert. Miss Wilson was a poor sickly thing, lachrymose and low-spirited, not worth the trouble of vanquishing, in short, and Mrs. Grey was coarse and insensible. No blow took effect on her. But poor Madame Joubert! I see her yet in her raging passions, when we had driven her to extremities, spilt our tea, crumbled our bread and butter, tossed our books up to the ceiling, and played a charivari with the ruler and desk, the fender and fire irons. Theodore, do you remember those merry days?"
"Yes, to be sure I do," drawled Lord Ingram, "and the poor old stick used to cry out, 'Oh, you villains, childs!' And then we sermonized her on the presumption of attempting to teach such clever blades as we were, when she was herself so ignorant."
"We did, and Teddo, you know, I helped you in prosecuting or persecuting your tutor, way-faced Miss Divining, the parson in the pip, as we used to call him. He and Miss Wilson took the liberty of falling in love with each other. At least Teddo and I thought so. We surprised sundry tender glances and sighs, which we interpreted as tokens of la belle passion, and I promise you the public soon had the benefit of our discovery. We employed it as a sort of lever to hoist our dead weights from the house. Dear Mama, there, as soon as she got an inkling of the business, found out that it was of an immoral tendency, did you not, my lady mother?"
"Certainly, my best, and I was quite right. Depend on that, there are a thousand reasons why liaisons between governesses and tutors should never be tolerated a moment in any well-regulated house. Firstly—"
"Oh, gracious Mama, spare us the enumeration. Oh, rest. We all know them. Danger of bad example to innocence of childhood, distractions and consequent neglect of duty on the part of the attached, mutual alliance and reliance, confidence thence resulting, insolence accompanying, mutiny and general blow-up. Am I right, Baroness Ingram of Ingram Park?"
"My lily flower, you are right now, as always."
"Then no more need be said. Change the subject."
Amy Eshton, not hearing or not heeding this dictum, joined in with her soft, infantine tone.
"Louisa and I used to quiz our governess, too, but she was such a good creature. She would bear anything. Nothing put her out. She was never cross with us, was she, Louisa?"
"No, never. We might do what we pleased, ransack her desk and her workbox, and turn her drawers inside out. And she was so good-natured, she would give us anything we asked for."
I suppose now, said Miss Ingram, curling her lips sarcastically, we shall have an abstract of the memoirs of all the governesses extant. In order to avert such a visitation, I again move the introduction of a new topic. Mr. Rochester, do you second my motion?
Madam, I support you on this point as on every other.
Then on me be the onus of bringing it forward.
Signor Eduardo, are you in voice tonight? Donna Bianca, if you command it, I will be. Then, signor, I lay on you my sovereign behest to furbish up your lungs and other vocal organs, as they will be wanted on my royal service. Who would not be the Rizzio of so divine a Mary?
A fig for Rizzio, cried she, tossing her head with all its curls as she moved to the piano. It is my opinion the fiddler David must have been an insipid sort of fellow. I like Black Bothwell better. To my mind, a man is nothing without a spice of the devil in him, and history may say what it will of James Hepburn, but I have a notion he was just the sort of wild, fierce bandit hero whom I could have consented to gift with my hand. Gentlemen, you hear. Now which of you most resembles Bothwell? Cried Mr. Rochester.
I should say the preference lies with you, responded Colonel Dent. On my honour, I am much obliged to you, was the reply.
Miss Ingram, who had now seated herself with proud grace at the piano, spreading out her snowy robes in queenly amplitude, commenced a brilliant prelude, talking meantime. She appeared to be on her high horse tonight. Both her words and her air seemed intended to excite not only the admiration, but the amazement of her auditors. She was evidently bent on striking them as something very dashing and daring indeed. "Oh, I am so sick of the young men of the present day!" exclaimed she, rattling away at the instrument. "Poor puny things, not fit to stir a step beyond Papa's park gates, nor to go even so far without Mama's permission and guardianship. Creatures so absorbed in care about their pretty faces and their white hands and their small feet, as if a man had anything to do with beauty, as if loveliness were not the special prerogative of woman, her legitimate appanage and heritage. I grant an ugly woman is a blot on the fair face of creation, but as to the gentlemen, let them be solicitous to possess only strength and valour. Let their motto be hunt, shoot, and fight. The rest is not worth a fillip. Such should be my device were I a man. Whenever I marry, she continued after a pause which none interrupted, I am resolved my husband shall not be a rival, but a foil to me. I will suffer no competitor near the throne. I shall exact an undivided homage. His devotion shall not be shared between me and the shape he sees in his mirror. Mr. Rochester, now sing, and I will play for you.
I am all obedience, was the response.
Here, then, is a corsair song. Know that I dote on corsairs, and for that reason sing it conspirato.
Commands from Miss Ingram's lips would put spirit into a mug of milk and water.
Take care, then, if you don't please me. I will shame you by showing how such things should be done.
That is offering a premium on incapacity. I shall now endeavour to fail.
Gardez-vous en bien, if you err wilfully, I shall devise a proportionate punishment.
Miss Ingram ought to be clement, for she has in her power to inflict a chastisement beyond mortal endurance.
Ha! Explain, commanded the lady.
Pardon me, madam, no need of explanation. Your own fine sense must inform you that one of your frowns would be a sufficient substitute for capital punishment.
Sing, said she, and again, touching the piano, she commenced an accompaniment in spirited style.
Now is my time to slip away, thought I, but the tones that then severed the air arrested me. Mrs. Fairfax had said Mr. Rochester possessed a fine voice. He did. A mellow, powerful bass, into which he threw his own feeling, his own force, finding a way through the ear to the heart, and there waking sensation strangely.
I waited till the last deep and full vibration had expired, till the tide of talk, checked an instant, had resumed its flow. I then quitted my sheltered corner and made my exit by the side door, which was fortunately near. Thence a narrow passage led into the hall. In crossing it, I perceived my sandal was loose. I stopped to tie it, kneeling down for that purpose on the mat at the foot of the staircase. I heard the dining-room door unclose. A gentleman came out. Rising hastily, I stood face to face with him. It was Mr. Rochester.
"How do you do?"
he asked. "I am very well, sir."
"Why did you not come and speak to me in the room?"
I thought I might have retorted the question on him who put it, but I would not take that freedom. I answered, "I did not wish to disturb you, as you seemed engaged, sir."
"What have you been doing during my absence?"
"Nothing particular. Teaching Adele, as usual."
"And getting a good deal paler than you were, as I saw at first sight. What is the matter?"
"Nothing at all, sir."
"Did you take any cold that night you half-drowned me?"
"Not the least."
"Return to the drawing-room. You are deserting too early."
"I am tired, sir." He looked at me for a minute.
"And a little depressed," he said. "What about? Tell me."
"Nothing. Nothing, sir. I am not depressed."
"But I affirm that you are. So much depressed that a few more words would bring tears to your eyes. Indeed, they are there now, shining and swimming, and a bead has slipped from the lash and fallen onto the flag.
If I had time and was not in mortal dread of some prating prig of a servant passing, I would know what all this means. Well, tonight I excuse you, but understand that so long as my visitors stay, I expect you to appear in the drawing-room every evening. It is my wish. Don't neglect it. Now go. And send Sophie for Adele. Good night, my—"
He stopped, bit his lip, and abruptly left me.